welcome to Straight Talk with MJ. I am your host, Michelle Jeanette, and this is, I believe, the first podcast episode 2021 that I am doing. I am so thankful that you're joining me, and I know it's been quite a while since I've done my last podcast. I believe was the 1st of December of 2020. A lot going on between back then and now. Absolutely a lot going on. So thank you for joining me. A lot of things have changed as far as social media, and really my actual physical location has changed. I haven't really shared much about that, but that's one of the things I was busy with over the last couple of months. And so I just wanted to thank you again for joining me. Whew, 2021 is shaping up to be quite a year. And we thought 2020 was crazy enough. It just might get crazier, huh? Well, thank you for joining me along, and let's go on this ride together. And it's going to be quite a ride, I would say. But today's episode is, I'm going to be talking about something that, just a title that I ran across in a CBN article, Christian Broadcasting Network. And it was kind of interesting. This terminology is kind of, I don't know, the last few years, I guess, has come to the surface. Christian nationalism. So I was interested to hear what they had to say about Christian nationalism. And first, I thought, okay, what is nationalism versus maybe patriotism? Do we know, is there like a big difference? And so nationalism, I looked this up, and there's several different meanings, and like anything, it can have a bad side and a good side. But nationalism is the belief that nations will benefit from acting independently rather than collectively, or like we would say globally, like globalism, emphasizing national rather than international goals. Okay, that's a pretty neutral definition. Another definition is devotion, especially excessive or undiscriminating devotion to the interests or culture of a particular nation state. So I guess nationalism could be used in a negative sense. They apply that word to people who are excessive or undiscriminating in their devotion to a country. I think the first thing that comes to mind for a lot of people when they hear nationalism is probably Hitler with the Nazis. But they, I think, warped that, what that really is supposed to mean. Because they took it and, you know, their definition of it was, this next definition is the belief that a particular culture or ethnic group constitutes a distinct people deserving of political self-determination. In other words, the Nazis took that word to the extreme. And so when we think of nationalism, we automatically think of that, you know, because their idea of that was just a pure white race, which is ludicrous, you know, in itself. Nobody that I know, especially any conservative that I know, thinks that was a good thing at all. Patriotism basically is love for or devotion to one's country. So there's, you know, similar definitions between nationalism and patriotism. They can kind of go in between. So it was a little concerning to me when I listened to, because it was a short little podcast, and it was just talking about Christian nationalism, and they were relating it to the January 6th Capitol event at the Capitol. Now, this again has been the things that happened that day the events that happened at the actual building, the Capitol building, of obviously has overshadowed what was happening there that was supposed to be happening that day. And it has was designed to be that way. And that is a whole other podcast episode that I can get into, which I probably will at some point, because you know, most people that know me or follow me know that my husband and I went to the November rally in D.C. We went to the December rally in D.C. And we also went to the January rally in D.C. So we saw a lot of things, and we saw what was supposed to be. And we saw wasn't what was not supposed to be. So a lot of bad actors that led this, and it really put, I think it drove the narrative for what's going on currently. So it's, they took that opportunity, and as I think it was Rahm Emanuel that was Obama's advisor, never let a good crisis go to waste, right? They always take it and run with it and push their agenda. You know, the left does that. So so I wanted to address this whole idea of Christian nationalism, because they're using it in a context of it being negative. And if we don't get ahead of this, it will be out there as something negative. Christian nationalism as being a negative connotation and having really bad implications. So I wanted to share with you what how they viewed it. And then I want to share with you what I think it's really supposed to mean. So the first thing I'll do is I'll let you listen to just a little excerpt from their podcast on CBN. It's with the host Caitlin Burke, and she is interviewing a lady, and she's talking about, she's referencing a professor from Georgetown University, and she talks about it really quick, but I just wanted you to hear their, definition of it, and then we'll talk about that here in just a sec. Let's let me turn this up here real quick. Hopefully you could be able to hear this.
People who study national security in the aftermath of January 6th, and in particular, Dr. Paul Miller at Georgetown University. He is a believer, he's a veteran, he's a national security expert, he's writing a book on Christian nationalism for University Press. And he says, you know, there were a lot of movements that day. There were people who were simply loyal to the president in that crowd. There were people who were convinced that the election was a fraud. There were people who really believe in the QAnon conspiracy theories. And then there were people who fall into this category of Christian nationalism, if you will. And that is what I've also been really trying to understand, is what is Christian nationalism? A lot of people are trying to understand it. And at the end of the day, Caitlin, I think what it is it's it really is a political ideology that uses Christian themes, but it really promotes one's political identity and one's love of country before anything else. And it really imposes a litmus test, political litmus test, on people, saying, you know, if you don't believe these political beliefs, you are not a Christian. And so it's a very constrained viewpoint, if you will. And while it alludes to the Bible and Christianity, I don't think you can make the case that it's biblical, because of course, as Christians, we put our top allegiance to Jesus and to Christ.
Okay, so obviously that last statement is correct. As a Christian, our top allegiance is to Christ. That's a given to any person who has a relationship with Jesus. We'll know that that is the truth, and that is obviously, I'm not debating that point at all. But what I do have issue with is lumping Christians who love their country in with the handful of people, because she was referencing also a picture of people kneeling in the Capitol that you know, broke in. I don't know if they personally broke in or if they just meandered it, because there was different groups that got into the Capitol, and that's, again, another episode. But, you know, if you have seen any of the videos, there were obviously some people who broke in and broke windows, and then there were those who the Capitol Police opened the door and let them in. And then you saw video of people just kind of meandering and wandering around like they were in line for a tour. It was kind of bizarre, but I think a lot of people that weren't up at the beginning maybe got in there over this kind of naive idea that maybe they were in there to go and speak to somebody with their opinions. I don't know. I really don't know why they went in there like they did. I can't answer that. But that, you know, she was referencing a picture of people praying in the Capitol building after they supposedly broke in, and relating that and labeling them as Christian nationalists, and then putting that visual with the word Christian nationalist. And then when you do that, anyone who is a Christian and loves their country gets lumped in with Christian nationalism. So that's why I wanted to address that issue today. I had to do a little research on the professor she was referencing. And let's see, what was his name? Well, let's see, his name. I have it in my papers here. Dr. Paul Miller. So I went and did some research on him, and I just pulled out on several of his articles, pulled out some quotes, just to kind of get a picture of maybe where he's coming from, how he thinks, looked at several different articles, especially on the topic of nationalism, and he's been writing about that, I believe, maybe for a while, but the furthest back I went was right after President Trump was elected in 2016. And so here's some of his quotes that I pulled from his articles. And some of them were good, talking about the founding of the country and stuff, which were good. But it kind of meanders off into this other thought. So I'll just read what he said. And this is coming from his article, The Jedi Are Selfless, Identity, Nationalism, the Humanities, and Liberalism. He addressed a lot of things in this one article. And he says, quote, "We express identity and look for recognition and validation in the public square. In our day, this drive takes many forms. When minority groups do this, we call it identity politics. When majority groups do the same thing, we call it nationalism. Nationalism is the identity politics of the majority tribe." I don't know. I have a little issue with that definition, but anyway. Identity politics is the nationalism of small groups. In each case, groups of people defined by some shared identity trait look to the public square for validation and affirmation. Nationalism and identity politics feed off of one another. As identities splinter and various minority groups demand recognition, majorities feel threatened that their polity is disintegrating. That makes majorities more keen to reaffirm their sense of identity as an antidote to the perceived fragmentation around them. He quotes this guy, Fukuyama, who says, "This crisis of identity leads to the search for a common identity that will rebind the individual to a social group and reestablish a clear moral horizon. This psychological fact lays the groundwork for nationalism. Nationalism is based on an intense nostalgia for an imagined past of strong community in which the division and confusions of a pluralist modern society did not exist." So his definition is an imagined nostalgia for an imagined past. Okay, so sure, there might be people who worship or, you know, idolize certain others, maybe founding fathers or something like that. But they're really taking that word nationalism and really, attaching really negative definitions to it. So I guess that was kind of my problem with it, because nationalism in my mind had never been negative. It had always been something where, like patriotism, you know, for love and devotion to country. And for me, it's always been not just love and devotion to country. Of course, I love America, but it's this whole notion of what it was founded on. And if you could take those principles and apply them and just throw them into any country in the world, they wouldn't necessarily work. And if you follow me, you understand, you know, I love history, but you understand what our founding fathers said about this constitutional republic, that it wouldn't work with just any form of government or any kind of people. Okay, this constitutional republic is built specifically for a religious and moral people, and that it wouldn't work with any other kind, because it would become like humans. You know, we are all human, so therefore government is filled with humans, and we're all flawed. And eventually, power consumes. And so, when you're left with just humans, any form of government, no matter how good it's set up, is going to disintegrate into the hands of a few, of the elite, of the powerful who grab for power. And we see that happening right before our eyes. That's what's happening now. So that's why I was like, nationalism is bad? So what he's done is, in several of these articles, he's attributed nationalism came back to life, so to speak, when Trump was elected in 2016. And made that a very negative thing. And so I want to explain to you that's not really what was going on. If you don't understand that, you don't understand the Trump, if you want to call it the Trump movement or the MAGA movement or whatever, you know, label you want to put on it. The other part of this article that really just bothered me because of how negative he makes this. Here is another part, and I don't remember if it was this article or another one. I have several that I have pulled quotes from and put them in a Word document. So he is saying, this is what he's saying here. Okay, in the process, let's see, in the process of rectifying historical wrongs, we have introduced new pathologies into our body politic. As we discussed earlier, identity politics can have a corrosive or centrifugal force on the culture of democracy. Now, a true democracy is not what America is. We are a constitutional republic, representatives. Democracy would be ruled by majority rule, and that's not what we are, because we're so big right now. And the way our founding father set it up was genius. It was divinely inspired. It was just genius. It was meant to be able to grow with the population. And the identity politics that he is describing here is perpetuated, and it is pushed, and I guess constantly perpetuated by the left, to always pit one group against another and to always make groups feel like they are victims of something. And inevitably, the victim, they're always victims of a white male authority, some type of white male authority. And so they make the evil person or the evil entity white men, especially conservative white men. And so that is where this division comes. And it is perpetuated constantly by the progressive left. And so when he talks about identity politics, really it's been thrust upon us by the progressive left for many decades now, but has become really, you know, just on another level of bad, if you want to call it that, here in the last few years. So this is what he has to qualify this, okay? So this is the whole paragraph that really concerned me, so that's why I wanted to do an episode on this. Here is what he said. Lest you think that I am just another conservative white man bashing progressive minority groups, let me be clear. While I do disagree with identity politics on the left, I am even more alarmed by the identity politics of the right, which is to say by the rise of nationalism. Okay. He says, I'm a patriot and a veteran of the armed forces and I love this country. But American nationalism is not mere love of country. Unfortunately, that is not true. Maybe he's coming at this from a liberal perspective, which seems to be more of that slant. He says, nationalism in George Orwell's phrase is the pursuit of competitive prestige. It is a demand for recognition of our national identity, and that national identity almost always gets defined by the majority tribe. Okay, that is why American nationalism is almost entirely a phenomenon of white Christians. I am not saying American nationalism is always a necessarily white nationalism. Sometimes it takes the form of Protestant nationalism, as when Christians insist that America is or should be a Christian nation. But regardless of its particular content, American nationalism has a long and troubling history of attracting fellow travelers who most certainly are belligerent, xenophobic, sectarian, and racist. And if you cannot recognize that, you are blind and willfully ignorant to the realities of American history. Go ask your closest non-white friend about American history. And if you don't have one, you are almost certainly part of the problem. Well, that is the whole issue that really spurred me on to do this episode. Was first the CBN podcast on Christian nationalism, which led me to this. And that view of white Christians and Christian nation and Christians in America and American nationalism is very wrong. And the xenophobic, sectarian, and racist section of our nation is not coming from the conservative, constitution-loving Americans. Okay? If you've noticed over the last few years, when the progressive left projects something onto conservatives, it is usually they themselves that are doing what they accuse the conservatives of doing. So to be racist and sectarian and the people that push identity politics is not coming from the conservative side or the constitution-loving side of people. You almost always see this coming from the progressive left. So I don't, you know, when you say that nationalism, American nationalism is almost always white Christians, I think maybe part of the problem is education. People are not educated to what this country was founded on. They are educated that this country was founded on slavery and racism, which is a total lie. I'm sorry, that's just a total lie. So if you believe that, please, I urge you to go to wallbuilders.com and do your research. They have the largest private collection of historical documents, over 100,000 of them. And many of them coming from the Revolutionary War and Founding Fathers era. You can't argue with actual documents, okay? So that's why I'm here today. I'm going to bring some this other definition, okay? This what I see it as and what I've studied it as for history. Now, am I a Harvard graduate or an Ivy League school graduate? Do I have doctorate degrees or in all of these, you know, fancy Ivy League colleges and universities? No. I have a bachelor's degree in international studies with a minor in German. And I don't remember how to speak German because I haven't used it in years. But I did love nations. I have always loved the nations. I am from Scotland. I love my Scottish history. Okay? I have Irish background. I love that. I have my great-great-grandmother was Cherokee Indian. I love that part of my heritage. That part of my history. I love studying about the Native Americans. And yes, I think they were treated horribly. I do not deny anything or any negative aspect of American history. Okay? I have always pushed for, you know, teaching the true history, which we don't do anymore. True history encompasses every part, okay? Not just picking out the bad parts and making that what, you know, making that the America's identity. Because it's not, okay? And when he says that, you know, Christians insist that America is or should be a Christian nation, that's a little flag for me, a red flag that tells me he doesn't believe that, okay? Well, I can prove to you that that is that he is wrong. I can prove to you that he is wrong. So in today's definition of nationalist, Christian nationalist, or whatever you want to call it, here's a question: would our founding fathers qualify as Christian nationalists? If you have studied or followed me or studied any history, you would probably say they would qualify or be defined, labeled as Christian nationalist. Okay? So, I want to bring this around to what I have studied as patriotism, nationalism, and maybe help you see that in not a negative light, but as it's a positive. Okay, there's a lot of things that I can incorporate into being positive. It's funny that I decided to do this episode on Christian nationalism, and one of the first articles I saw that popped up on the Epoch Times, it's kind of interesting, was conservative nationalism and U.S. foreign policy. Dated today. And I thought, well, how convenient. This is what I was going to talk about. And so they have the author Colin, and I don't know how to say his last name, Dweck, from the Epoch Times. It's an opinion piece. And it was very interesting that it came out the same time I was going to do this. So I'm going to read part of that. And he really describes it well. And this is what, this is the positive side. And so this is what we need to change it, you know, because the progressive left likes to co-opt language, and language is important, and so they like to use words and phrases and attach negative connotation to them. So I'm going to attach the positive part. So here's what he writes. At its most exemplary, conservative nationalism is a democratically oriented and civic form of patriotism, a love of a particular place, maintaining that the world is best governed by independent nation states, and that only within the context of such states can a free citizenry experiment with constitutional forms of self-rule. Okay, that's a fantastic definition of conservative nationalism, all right? In foreign policy, conservative nationalists focus on preserving and promoting their own country's interests, rights, values, security, traditions, and way of life in the belief that it is entirely legitimate to do so. Within the United States, a kind of conservative American nationalism was the mainstream bipartisan political and foreign policy tradition for most of the country's history. But America's founders also hoped that the nation's example of popular self-government would eventually spread worldwide, and they saw no contradiction between holding out that hope, or even pressing it forward, and preserving U.S. national sovereignty. As a matter of historical record, the original American colonies were founded by English Protestant settlers, and this specific cultural and religious heritage provided the context for U.S. founding principles. Over the years, some U.S. nationalists have defined their identity mainly in religious or ethnic terms. This has long encouraged tensions between an ethnic definition of the American nation and a civic one. Yet, in their Declaration of Independence, the American revolutionaries stated that all men are created equal, justifying their rebellion in part by claiming certain universal natural rights. These claims were informed by beliefs well described as classically liberal. There has consequently been within the United States, from the very beginning, a kind of American creed, a civic religion or national identity with some notably classical liberal elements, including the rule of law, individual freedom, majority rule, equality of right, enterprise, progress, and limited government. As 19th century Marxists such as Friedrich Engels noted, this classical liberal creed made it difficult to promote a socialism within the United States. This is what Engels meant by American exceptionalism, and he found it exceptionally frustrating. So, why is this deteriorating now, American exceptionalism? Because of our educational system and what our kids are being taught. That's another whole episode. And if you want to know, I would highly recommend subscribing to the Epic Times. And they have a whole section on how communism has infiltrated and has affected our educational system. It is fantastic. And it's eye-opening. And it's shocking. And it would probably really just shock you to know how much they have infiltrated our educational system, primary and secondary. But again, that's a different subject, time for another episode, whatever. So I love that definition there of the nationalism. So here's kind of another, here's my take on this too. The reason it, as the professor from Georgetown was talking about, it became popular, or the rise of it became popular under Trump. And if you don't understand Trump, like Rush Limbaugh always says, they will never understand Trump or the followers of Trump or his voters. If you don't understand the fact that Trump was almost like the voice that we didn't have, okay? We, for years, especially the 8 years during the Obama administration, but it started with, you know, going back to Bush 1, Clinton, and Bush 2, as conservatives, as Republicans, and we'd vote for Republicans time after time, they would let us down. They would not fight for our principles. They would cave. They would cave to the media. They would cave to media shaming. Oh, you're going to be called racist if you oppose any kind of policy, or if you oppose President Obama himself, you were racist. They turned that narrative. And so Republicans were we became pretty frustrated because our voices were not being heard, and Republicans would claim that they would go to represent us, and then they would turn on us. And that happened over and over again, and during the Obama years, it became more and more prevalent where nobody was standing up for what the majority of the people wanted, which was a constitutional republic. And we could see the powers that were coming in, the globalist powers, and we understood in 2016, we understood what a Hillary president would be. It would be the end. It would be the end of a constitutional republic. It would become the beginning of a globalist America. It would no longer be America that our founders, were so divinely inspired to establish. So we understood the situation that we were in. And when Trump came out on the scene and we saw him versus all the other establishment Republicans, we knew that he was our only shot at keeping this constitutional republic. Now, on a personal note, I was for Ted Cruz. My husband and I actually were, he was the county chair for the Ted Cruz campaign in the primaries. Many of us here in our county were Ted Cruz supporters. There were a few that were Trump supporters, but we could see Ted Cruz. I love that he pretty much knew the Constitution inside and out. And he was, he had memorized it. He knew it. He was the debate champ of his college. He had, clerked for Antonin Scalia. I mean, he was great. He was supposedly, a Christian and all this. And so in the primaries, we thought, no way. And then Trump won the nomination and we were pretty disappointed. So, I was not initially a Trump supporter. But as time went on, I saw what Trump was doing. And then now I can see, looking back, why everyone hated him. Because he was the only thing standing between globalism, the elite, the establishment, and what 70 million people, now 80 million plus people, wanted was to keep our constitutional republic with our individual freedoms. And I'm going to read this to you really quick. This happened in January. This is what we are fighting against. And the World Economic Forum had their Davos meeting and their Great Reset. And this is another article from the Epoch Times. And this is what we are up against. This is what a lot of us understood what could happen if Trump didn't win in 2016. And now, as we're seeing, that he didn't win in 2020, that he did not get reelected. Okay, we know he won, and again, when they talk about those who think the election was stolen as some kind of conspiracy theorist, they are the ones that are wrong, not us. I'm just going to say that. How come they are the ones that get to point fingers and tell us we're wrong when it's 75, 80 million people understood what was right and saw what was happening? That's a whole other issue, podcast episode too. So this article in the Epoch Times by Ryan Moffitt is called Missing from the World Economic Forum's Great Reset, A Moral Compass. And he says this: globalization has afforded non-governmental organizations, the ultra-wealthy, and big tech power and influence on a global scale once reserved for the world's superpower states. The World Economic Forum, which describes itself as an international organization for public-private cooperation, has proposed a Great Reset initiative to rework global economies to address the challenges of the post-pandemic world. The WEF paints a picture of a 2030 in which America will lose its place as the preeminent superpower, a billion people will be displaced by climate change, carbon will be taxed globally, and you, quote, and you will own nothing and be happy. So that is basically what's going to happen here. The WEF frames the afflictions of the world primarily in economic and climate terms, while advocating that individual property rights can be discarded, privacy can be sacrificed, and national sovereignty can be dissolved, all for the greater good of addressing these two so-called existential threats, climate change. What was the other one? Climate change was the biggest one, they say. So, that is what we knew we were fighting against. And so I went to my favorite Bible is the Founders Bible from wallbuilders.com. And I did some research online and I did some research in scripture. And I know that I'm already at 35 minutes here, but I was trying to make this 30 minutes. It's just not working. There's just too much to talk about. So I went to several scriptures because I know that nations are established by God. We are not to be one world governed by one ruler. We are to be nations, nation states. They talk about sheep nations and goat nations. Lance Wallnau describes it really well. And this whole idea of national sovereignty is something that's, you know, it is a biblical thing. And when they say it's not, you know, Christians shouldn't be putting nation above God. Well, many of us understand that we wouldn't have an America without God. And if you understand history, you would know that. You would understand that we would not have an America without God. And anyway, so I'm going to get into a little bit of that. So for my history part of the podcast episode, I'm going to read to you from the Founders Bible, and it's really, really good. So, and if you have the Founders Bible, this is on page 807, and it refers to Psalm 9, verse 17, and Psalm 9:17 says, "The wicked will return to Sheol, even all the nations who forget God." So it's talking about nations. So on page 807 in the Founders Bible, again, this is from wallbuilders.com. It's called The Duty of Nations. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 reminds us that in all our ways, public as well as private, we are to acknowledge Him. And while it is wisdom for individuals, it is also true of nations. In response to the idolatry of others or their failure to acknowledge God, Psalm 79, verse 6 and Jeremiah 10:25 call for God's wrath upon all nations that do not call upon His name. And the warranty of 1 Samuel 2, verse 30 that says, "Those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me will be lightly esteemed," was delivered to civil leaders, not religious ones. The psalmist said in Psalm 9, verse 17, "The wicked return to Sheol, even all the nations who forget God." Whenever we stop acknowledging Him, whether as an individual or as a nation, we then begin to forget Him, and at that point, we are in trouble. Understanding this truth, President George Washington emphatically declared this: "It is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful to His benefits, for His benefits, and to humbly to implore His protection and favor." Notice the four duties that Washington said pertain to nations. Number one, acknowledge God. Number two, obey His will. Number three, be grateful for His aid. And number four, implore His protection and favor. President John Adams concurred and similarly declared, "The safety and prosperity of nations ultimately and essentially depend on the protection and the blessing of Almighty God, and the national acknowledgement of this truth is an indispensable duty which the people owe to him. President Thomas Jefferson agreed, and in his first inaugural address reminded the nation that the first thing necessary to make us a happy and prosperous people was acknowledging and adoring an overruling providence. The convictions that America should publicly acknowledge God was frequently expressed by our national leaders. In fact, President Abraham Lincoln not only did so, but even warned the nation in his day that it was beginning to forget God. It is the duty of nations as well, Abraham Lincoln said, and to recognize this sublime truth announced in the Holy Scriptures and proven by all history that those nations are only are blessed whose God is the Lord. But we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace and multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. And we have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to pray to the God that made us. For this reason, President Lincoln called the nation to a time of public humiliation, fasting, and prayer, so that it would once again remember God. The Founding Fathers would never have supported any public policy that would prohibit such expressions and thus invite us as a nation to forget God. So when you say that America was not founded on Christian principles, that is just an outright lie. This Founders Bible is full of little excerpts like this and stories and quotes from our Founding Fathers that prove that otherwise. All right, the other last thing was page 957, and this is also from the Founders Bible, and of course it talks about righteousness exalts a nation. That's Proverbs 14:34, and that says, pull that over here. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a disgrace to any people. America's founding fathers were concerned not just about their own generation, but also about posterity, about future generations. In fact, when they wrote the U.S. Constitution, they candidly acknowledged that they had done so in order to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Reflecting this concern in an election sermon preached to the Connecticut legislature, the Reverend Matthias Burnett admonished citizens and leaders, quote, "To God and posterity you are accountable for your rights and your rulers. Let not your children have reason to curse you for giving up those rights and prostrating those institutions which your fathers delivered to you." He reminded citizens that while they would give an account to God for whether or not they had preserved the rights he had entrusted them, they would also answer to future generations, to posterity. So those are just little quotes. The last part of this, I love that this is from page 957, called Righteousness Exalts a Nation. And this is also from Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, a minister of the gospel who also served as a political leader long before and after the Civil War, told citizens, "I have one great political idea. That idea is an old one. It is widely and generally assented to. Nevertheless, it is very generally trampled upon and disregarded. The best expression of it I have found in the Bible. It is in substance. Righteousness exalts a nation. Sin is a reproach to any people. Sir, this constitutes my politics, the negative and positive of my politics, and the whole of my politics. I feel it my duty to do all in my power to infuse this idea into the public mind, that it may speedily be recognized and practiced upon by our people." So, that is Frederick Douglass. You remember him, right? Okay, one last thing. Douglas believed that every political concern should be guided by issues of righteousness, but too often today, political concerns and even citizen votes are guided instead by issues of economics. This is a great quote, Reverend Francis Grimke. The Reverend Francis Grimke understood this. Born to a slave mother in 1850 in South Carolina, he served as a valet in the Confederate Army until emancipation. After the war, he attended Lincoln University, Howard University, and Princeton Theological Seminary and became a minister in Washington, D.C. He not only lived through the Civil War as a boy, but as a young man survived the barbarity of the Ku Klux Klan over the two decades following the war. Then, in the early 1900s, as an older adult, he watched the second revival of the Klan as it marched openly in parades in D.C., with many members of Congress participating. Having personally witnessed the literal splitting apart of America, and now seeing the resurgence of the Klan with the same tone and rhetoric as 50 years earlier, he was convinced that this time the nation would remain united. But in a sermon delivered in 1909, he warned what America's future would be should we ever depart from righteousness. And we, you know, the preceding the Civil War, or during the Civil War, we had the Second Great Awakening. The First Great Awakening happened right before the Revolutionary War, which kind of led into the whole thing of freedoms. Religious freedom, personal freedom, national freedom. This is what Reverend Grimke said. The stars and stripes, the old flag, will float over all these states. If the time ever comes when we shall go to pieces, it will be from inward corruption, from the disregard of right principles, from losing sight of the fact that righteousness exalts a nation, but that sin is a reproach to any people. The secession of the southern states in 1860 was a small matter with the secession of the Union itself from the great principles enunciated in the Declaration of Independence, in the Golden Rule, in the Ten Commandments, in the Sermon on the Mount. Unless we hold and hold firmly to these great fundamental principles of righteousness, our union will be only a covenant with death and an agreement with hell, from Isaiah 28:18. If it continues to exist, it will be a curse and not a blessing. When selecting public officials, Christians must make their first and foremost concern not what can be done for their pocketbook or their job, but rather whether that official will advance policies upholding biblical standards of righteousness. So many people thought Trump was a bully on his tweets. Didn't like the way he tweeted. But, you know, they went with Biden. But, you know, his policies are everything that goes against any biblical standard that we have. It's just, anyway, it's hard to look at that and see, but, you know, we are going through this for a reason, and we'll see what it is. And maybe it was because we had to expose all this deep corruption that's going on in our government. So the last thing I'm going to read to you is an excerpt from a speech, and I wanted to read this, and then I'll give you, you know, where this came from. All right. This speech, here it says this. We gather tonight to herald the most important day in the history of nations, July 4th, 1776. At those words, every American heart should swell with pride. Every American family should cheer with delight. And every American patriot should be filled with joy. Because you, each of you lives in the most magnificent country in the history of the world. Our founders launched not only a revolution in government, but a revolution in the pursuit of justice, equality, liberty, and prosperity. No nation has done more to advance the human condition than the United States of America, and no people have done more to promote human progress than the citizens of our great nation. It was all made possible by the courage of 56 patriots who gathered in Philadelphia 244 years ago and signed the Declaration of Independence. They enshrined a divine truth that changed the world forever when they said, "All men are created equal." These immortal words set in motion the unstoppable march of freedom. Our founders boldly declared that we are all endowed with the same divine rights given to us by our Creator in heaven, and that which God has given us, we will allow no one ever to take away. Let's see. Going on down here, towards the end of this, let's read this part. Okay, we will state the truth in full without apology. We declare that the United States of America is the most just and exceptional nation ever to exist on earth. We are proud of the fact that our country was founded on Judeo-Christian principles, and we understand that these values have dramatically advanced the cause of peace and justice throughout the world. We know that the American family is the bedrock of American life. We recognize the solemn right and moral duty of every nation to secure its borders. We remember that government exists to protect the safety and happiness of their own people. A nation must care for its own citizens first. So we must take care of America first. We believe in equal opportunity, equal justice, and equal treatment for citizens of every race, background, religion, and creed. Every child of every color, born and unborn, is made in the holy image of God. We want free and open debate, not speech codes and cancel culture. We embrace tolerance, not prejudice. We support the courageous men and women of law enforcement. We will never abolish our police or our great Second Amendment, which gives us the right to keep and bear arms. We believe that our children should be taught to love their country, honor our history, and respect our great American flag. We stand tall, we stand proud, and we only kneel to Almighty God. This is who we are, this is what we believe, and these are the values that will guide us as we strive to build an even better and greater future. Those who seek to erase our heritage want Americans to forget our pride and our great dignity so that we can no longer understand ourselves or America's destiny. In toppling the heroes of 1776, they seek to dissolve the bonds of love and loyalty that we feel for our country and that we feel for each other. Their goal is not a better America, their goal is the end of America. And yes, that was said by President Trump at Mount Rushmore. On the Independence Day celebration. Yeah, so he got it. He understood that this nation was not a nation without God, and he acknowledged God at every turn. Whenever he was in a speech, if you even tried to listen to him, you would hear that he acknowledged God, Almighty God, and that we worship God, not government. He said that repeatedly. And so if Christian nationalism is the definition to me, is love of history, love of knowing that this nation was divinely inspired, that it promotes equality for all men, that we're all created equal, we're all endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, the life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, and that those rights are instituted by God but are protected. Governments are set there with the narrow job of just protecting those rights. That's their job, you know, the safety and security and national security. That's their job, to protect those freedoms that God gives us. And we have seen that be erased. We've seen it under attack. Now, those who believe that, if you want to call me, that's my definition of Christian nationalism, and you want to call that, make that a negative, or now you want to label those people that believe that as terrorists, domestic terrorists, extremists, You want to label those people that believe that extremist? I guess our founding fathers were extremists. So that is how I changed the definition of Christian nationalism. All right, that's how I would define it. Not the way that the professor did or the way that CBN did. That is not the correct way to define Christian nationalism. And so I hope you will take that and share that and maybe do a little more studying on that. But go to good sources like the Epoc Times, okay? The National Pulse, Revolver.News. These people are really fighting for what America stands for. So if America was terrible and so racist and so evil, why are so many people from around the world risking everything to come here? Why do people risk leaving their country to come here for a better life if America is that bad, that racist, and that evil? It's not. Okay? It's only that evil to those people who, for some reason or another, who have made them, America has made them successful, but they hate her for it. So, yes, we all have our experiences with America, and there's good experiences and there's bad experiences. But the foundational principles of this country are what has perpetuated freedoms for everyone that comes here and has worked tirelessly to spread the gospel, the love of Jesus around the world. So that's my definition of Christian nationalism, and that's what I'm going to stick with. The people that don't appreciate or love her, that, you know, what she was founded on, it's probably because they don't really understand the history of it. So that's why I try to bring you that history and that, you know, for that reason. Thank you for joining me again with Straight Talk with MJ. I went a whole hour. It's crazy how time just flies by. You can now, I'm getting off Facebook. You can now follow me on Gab, G-A-B, as in boy. And you can just go into the search bar and type Straight Talk with MJ, all one word, and you'll find me. And it has my little logo on there, and you can follow my page on Gab. And this is where I will publish my podcast. I will share my podcast on Gab. Of course, you can still go to my website, straighttalkwithmj.net. Go down to the bottom of the homepage and sign up with your email. And anytime I publish my podcast, you will be the first to know, because it'll come straight to your email. And you just click the link in the email, and it'll take you right to the podcast episode. So, anyway, I'm not going to be on Facebook too much longer. It's taken a little time to get off of there, trying to move everything over. And so follow me on Gab, and that right now is my social media, Gab. I do have trying to maybe set up a Telegram, maybe do a Telegram channel, but I'm not 100% sure if I'm going to do that or if I'll work that out. But anyway, thanks for following me, for listening. And I appreciate your support. Please share this. Since I'm not on Facebook anymore, I won't be able to get the word out as much. So I'm going to rely on you guys to send this to a couple of friends. If every one of you sends it to a few friends, and they can send it to a few friends, encourage them. I just want to be able to talk to you guys and, you know, combine this Christian worldview of current events with love of history. So anyway, thank you guys again, and we will talk again soon.